Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, the Prime Minister has unveiled sweeping changes to the planning system that could see councils forced to consider building on greenbelt land in England. But is this a compromise that should be made to fix Britain's housing crisis?
We'll also discuss Reform UK's incredible year as their political ambitions go from strength to strength. Should the other political parties be worried?
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
What do we want from Europe? If we want trade, friendship, cooperation, reciprocity, we don't need a European Commission. We don't need a European Court. We don't need these institutions and all of this power. And I can promise you, both in UKIP and indeed in the Brexit Party, we love Europe. We just hate the European Union.
Well, that was then, Mr. Farage, and this is now. A majority of Britons who voted to leave the EU would now accept a return to free movement in exchange for access to the single market, according to a cross-Europe study that also found a reciprocal desire in member states for closer links with the UK. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Donald Trump's election as US president had, quote, fundamentally changed the context of EU-UK relations, the report by the European Council on Foreign Relations think tank said. There is a remarkable consensus on both sides of the channel that the time is ripe for a reassessment of EU-UK relations, it concluded, with closer relations being the most popular option in every country surveyed, and public opinion on the question well ahead of government stances. Perhaps the most striking finding was that 54% of Britons who voted to leave, including 59% of voters in Redwall seats, said in exchange for single market access, they would now accept full free movement for EU and UK citizens to travel, live and work across borders. Ali, is this significant? Do we need to conclusively move on from Brexit, or is there a new future that involves getting closer to the EU again?
First of all, I'm a little sceptical of the poll because, you know, sometimes when polls are so far beyond your expectation, you then kind of go into the methodology. So this is a cross-European poll that included, I think, Germany and other France and other countries as well. I know it did a specific UK section as well. But I'm a little bit sceptical about the conclusions it's reached in terms of how many Britons would accept full movement of people, given how large the immigration conversation in the country is. But that being said, I think the headline is right in that the world is a very different place today than it was when the Brexit vote has happened. And the best example of that is Donald Trump. We now have a president of the United States that is increasingly isolationist, increasingly disconnected from the rest of the world. And that has huge implications on us as the United Kingdom. The UK is no longer the British Empire, right, where we have our hands and feet all across the world. We're a relatively small island and with not a huge amount of export and import in terms of our own produce that we produce and our own security. I think a briefing from a military expert this week said that the UK in a conventional warfare would last about 6 months. So if you look at Donald Trump's sort of hesitancy and his skepticism on NATO, for example, the war in Russia with Ukraine, I think we have to reevaluate where we sit in the world and how American dependent we are. And if we're not American dependent, then we need to foster closer relationships with the European Union, or we end up as a small isolationist island with no power, no influence, and a fledgling economy. So what I would suggest to the British voter and those listening is there are two options, right? We're either in bed with Donald Trump or we foster closer ties with the European Union. There is no third option.
Can you do both?
You could do both. Yes, you could. Yeah, and I think that probably...
But could you, though? Because say, for example, that Donald Trump does want to pull the plug on the support in Ukraine and say that Russia... I mean, these are all hypotheticals, but say that Russia ups the ante, you know... We then could find a situation where, say, the US pulls its support from NATO, say it pulls its support from Ukraine, where actually the EU and the US have different ambitions, different agendas, yep. and we find ourselves caught in the crosshairs between the two. I mean, yes, in theory we could. How likely is that scenario, do you think?
It's likely, largely because Donald Trump is so unpredictable and he's so anti-war. Mm. So what Donald Trump has exposed is how dependent Europe is on America's sort of arm of security in terms of our own safety, particularly from Russian aggression. And I don't think that's sustainable anymore. I don't think we can be entirely reliant on the United States to come and save us. And this is European countries more widely. And I think there needs to be a conversation in Europe about how independently Europe can defend itself, sovereign countries as well as the more sort of allied European countries, particularly from Russian aggression. Mm. And so that's I think, an imminent question that needs to be answered. And Donald Trump would certainly be there. But it's also economic. I don't think it's just... I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's positions on tariffs and other things and his willingness to punish countries economically. Look at Canada. Mm. Look at what he said about Canada. Either you become the 51st state or we place tariffs on you. He said that in the last week. So I think our dependency on America is a problem. Could you do both? You probably could, but there are tensions on different policy points in each. So I think it's a serious question in terms of both foreign and domestic, in terms of economic and security questions on the UK. And I think people are getting that. Mm. I think people understand. Again, I have a higher sort of bar of the British public, I think, than some of our politicians here. I think people get that. Even the ones that saw Brexit as a sovereignty question understand that our future in terms of the economy and on security has to be tied with Europe because it no longer can be secure with America.
So I just want to point out something that made me chuckle, which is across the EU, pluralities in every country polled agreed. 45% of Germans said they want a closer relationship with the UK, as well as 44% of Poles, 41% of Spaniards, 40% of Italians, and 34% of
French. There we go.
Why do the French hate us?
Do you know what? The French English beef baffles me.
I think we deserve it.
The French hate everyone.
Yeah. But they really hate us.
I'm leaning to speak French, by the way. So, yes.
Well, maybe you can become our... You can bring us closer ties.
I can negotiate.
So the thing I was going to say, right, if I was a Lib Dem...
Yeah.
Who famously, you know, the Lib Dems were very, very keen on staying in the EU and have been very kind of anti-Brexit. I would look at this and think we need to become the party of make the EU great again. Because Labour don't want to touch it because it's politically contentious. Lib Dem voters love the EU. The Lib Dems are a little bit rudderless at the minute. Mm. They are there. They're the third largest party. They took a lot of Tory votes. They need to think about what it is they stand for when both kind of when Labour's sort of flirting with the centre ground and the Tories are shifting right. What do the Lib Dems do? And if I were a Lib Dem, I think we need to become the ones spearheading the rejoining the EU campaign.
Yeah, first of all, centre's very kind on Labour. I think in terms of identity, you're right. It would give the Liberal Democrats a serious identity in terms of political strategy and direction. Mm. The problem is, I still believe, and this is entirely Ali's gut, so I don't have any polling to back this up, but I think a serious majority in this country don't want to reopen the Brexit debate because of just how contentious and how fatigued we are with it. Both Leave and Remain just don't want that issue to become dominant again. And I think you may find yourself in a minority in terms of momentum and wave of people who just don't want to open the issue up again. So while a majority of Britons might think that we need to re-enter the single market and other things, how many of them actually want Brexit to once again, or the European Union once again, to dominate our political space? I think it'll be a majority don't. And the worry that I would have in terms of, if you're a party that's looking for a majority in Westminster, I don't think it's there with Brexit and the European Union being your major issue. But I also, hand on heart, don't think the Liberal Democrats intend, at least in the short and medium term, at all to be the majority party in Westminster.
Which is what...
Which might help them.
So they can target it. Because it just shows you how almost dishonest our politics are when we know how much leaving the EU has damaged us across almost every kind of policy area.
Like, admitted by Farage himself.
For then there to be a kind of gentleman's agreement that we don't discuss it. You know, it's just such a strange...
Yeah.
It's just such a strange rule of modern politics.
Particularly because the two main parties are so afraid of it. Mm. So because the Conservatives don't want to touch it because it splits them internally, and Labour don't want to touch it because they think that the Red Wall voters are so Brexit that they're going to lose it. Mm. I guess that would support the Liberal Democrats charting their own sort of direction on it. But even Reform don't really want to talk about it anymore.
Well, no, because it's been disastrous. Yeah. I just want to ask you quickly before we move on. Do you think we're going to rejoin the single market at any point in Labour's tenure? No.
I think Starmer's just too afraid of this debate. Yeah.
And it hands Reform a good stick to
Make him especially with. Given... look, Keir Starmer's under significant pressure. Alex Wickham just revealed, I think he did a thread and a story on the significant pressures, not just coming from the left of the party, but from the right of the party as well, with Blairites universally unhappy with Starmer's leadership so far. Mm. I'd be surprised if Keir Starmer touches such a contentious issue when he's got such little political capital in the party himself.
Yes, got lots of things on his to-do list, I'm sure. Okay, moving on to our next story. Russian naval vessels appear to have temporarily left their main port in Syria amid continuing uncertainty about Moscow's future in the country after a fall of its ally and the country's former president, Bashar al-Assad. Well, if you've been following the news, rebel fighters have captured the Syrian capital of Damascus, toppling the regime that has been power in the country since 1971. Forces led by the opposition group, the HTS, entered the city in the early hours of Sunday morning before appearing on state television to declare Syria to now be free. Assad, the nation's former president, is now known to have fled to Moscow. Ali, let's talk about this. There's so much to unpick here. The conflict and the rapidity of the fall of Assad's regime is shocking. There's no doubt it was barbaric, but what is set to replace it? And what about Russia? What about Israel? Where does this leave everything else going on, not only in the Middle East, but across the West?
So look, it's a question. First of all, this has been hugely unexpected, the speed at which our rebel forces have been able to kick out Assad. What it shows is how reliant the regime was on Russian and Iranian support to maintain power, and the crimes committed against the Syrian people by that sort of axis of Assad, Russia and Iran is brought to light even more. Some of the barbarity that we're seeing is horrendous. We're now seeing prisons under prisons, prisons under hospitals. They're often described by journalists on the ground as whole cities underground of political prisoners, some of whom have been dead for many, many years in their cells, some many malnourished and who haven't seen light and other things. So that, like you said, the barbarity of Assad's rule and reign aren't in question. The question is what happens next. That's a question for the Syrian people. And this is where I hope some of my left-wing colleagues pay attention, because they're so monumentally wrong about this. There is an uncertainty about the future of Assad, and some are worried that it becomes an Israeli client state, some are worried it becomes a United States client state, etc., etc., etc. None of these are arguments for Syrian people living under a tyrannical regime. Assad had to go, no question about that. You can't, because of your sort of game of geopolitics, subject an entire people to a tyranny because you disagree with who may then have influence on that state. That's not how human rights works. That's not how morality works. And a lot of my colleagues on the left don't seem to get this. So could Israel have more influence in Syria's future? I don't think so. I think it's very unlikely, but it's possible. Could America have more influence in Syria now? Possibly. I don't think it's likely, but it's possible. That possibility doesn't mean that the Syrian people should be further subjugated to Assad's sort of brutal regime for years to come. So it's undoubted that Assad leaving is a good thing. The worry for me isn't actually other client states getting involved, is that it goes the way of Egypt, where they had free and fair elections. Very quickly, the army swept in and we're back to dictatorship now. So what should happen in Syria is that the Syrian people get free and fair elections in a democratic country and elect whoever they want. The problem the West has sometimes is we're all for democracy as long as the result is what we want. And I'll tell you this right now. Here's my prediction that we'll come back to. If there are free and fair elections, the Syrian people, I suspect, would pick the Islamist party. And we can't then come back and say, well, that's not quite the answer we were looking for.
And is that
the way we did with Egypt?
And is that the party that originally declared Syria to now be free?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's and that is the party, if I'm correct in thinking, that Labour are now considering
removing from the Torah.
Yes. Unprescribing or deprescribing or whatever it's
called.
So
for people who know HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, have links or former links with Al-Qaeda, and they are on the prescribed terrorism list in the UK now. Pat McFadden said the UK would look into it, although Kirsten, in terms of removing them from the prescribed terror groups, although Keir Starmer said it's too early for that.
Do you think it would be a risk if they did?
I don't think at this point, no, because I think the group is very different to what it was under Al-Qaeda, and the leader is likely to be the first president of Syria, if by my sort of predictions. So look, their conduct I'm not entirely sure with. We're going to have to look into that, and their links we're going to have to look into. But they are likely to be major power brokers in Syria now. And this is the key thing. If there are free and fair elections in Syria, what we can't do is then turn around to the Syrian people and say, you picked the wrong ones.
Yeah.
That's their prerogative.
I just want to ask you before we move on, what do you think is going to happen to Assad now? Is Putin going to take good care of him in Moscow, do you think?
Yeah.
He's not of any use to Putin anymore.
No, but what we have to remember is Assad will be a signal to other client states that Russia has, because other leaders will want to know that if this ever happened to them, that they would be safe in Moscow. Mm. So Assad will never be handed back to the Syrian people from the Russians, because other clients that Russia controls will be looking at what happens to Assad in terms of, that could happen to me one day. And that's the thinking that sometimes these sort of puppet countries will think about. So I think Assad is safe in Moscow, but I hope he is as uncomfortable as one can possibly be.
Very interesting. Thank you, Ali. Okay, that is the week unwrapped. Coming up, can Labour solve Britain's housing crisis? Well, the Prime Minister is setting out plans today that could see councils forced to consider building on Greenbelt land. The right decision or a compromise too far? That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SIS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously they can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you. What's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, Sir Keir Starmer has revealed sweeping changes to the planning system that could see councils forced to consider building on Greenbelt land in England. The Prime Minister has vowed to override blockers standing in the way of building the new homes needed to solve the housing crisis. After a two-month consultation, ministers will set out the final version of changes to the National Planning Policy Framework. The government says it will give councils mandatory targets to deliver 370,000 homes a year in England, prioritise brownfield sites, which are disused areas that have been developed in the past, for new buildings, provide 100 million for councils and 300 additional planning officers to speed up the planning process, and order councils to identify lower quality greenbelt land or greybelt land which could be built on. But some locals in the areas where these houses will need to be built are steadfast in their opposition to more housing. Ali, do you think building on the Greenbelt is the right idea to solve Britain's housing crisis, or do these so-called NIMBYs have a point?
No, I think this is the correct path. Look, I think the housing crisis in real time, in terms of material impacts on people in Britain, is probably right up there next to the NHS in terms of the most impactful day-to-day on people's lives in terms of rent, affordability, habitability of houses, etc., etc. And we cannot continue the path that we've been going down. We cannot solve this problem while everyone is saying, yeah, but somewhere else. Mm. Yeah, but somewhere else. Just for clarity, people listening, because I didn't know this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Zoe. So Greenbelt is just that, all the green land in Britain, which is protected in terms of being built on. And part of the idea is to maintain Britain's sort of natural look and feel and environment. And brownfield sites are sort of disused areas, like you said, that have been developed on in the past, but may now not be habited or inhabitable. And greybelt is a sort of quasi-term for lower quality greenbelt land.
Yes.
So that's like, we've all seen them, that it's technically sort of natural, but it's just shrubbery.
Well, it can be car parks, quarries, scrubland.
Yeah.
It's...
And I don't think anyone would disagree that those areas should be built on.
No, it's not green and pleasant in the way that people think greenbelt land.
But you know much more about this than me, so I'm going to ask you, do the NIMBYs have a point? And our rights, our Labour rights, because there's been a lot of conversation with Labour saying they're just going to, so Keir Starmer's looking for ways of almost bypassing councils who aren't being helpful and just demanding that things be built.
I think that's the correct way to go, because we know that councils have are often overrun with various interested parties who, for many different reasons, are opposed to development in their areas. And this isn't just housing, this is things like prisons.
Yeah.
This is things like new infrastructure projects as well. And in fact, one of the proposals is that they can override councils, the MOJ can, so that they can build new prisons. Something we know nobody wants a prison built next to their house, but unfortunately, we need more prisons.
Yeah, and the report this week shows that even with Labour releasing a bunch of prisoners, we're still almost at full capacity now.
So, mandatory targets, you know, as you say, this is an issue of utmost national importance. So it's right that it is overseen by the very centre of government. And I think it's right that the government can override councils where local interests seem to be able to override national value. This idea of reclassifying parts of the Greenbelt to become greybelt so that it can be built on, I think, is a good idea. You know, as you say, these areas that are technically greenbelt, but they're so ugly and they need, you know, they need development, is a good thing. What I do understand is when people are concerned about, okay, well, if you build loads of housing in my area, what are we going to do with the fact that we only have two primary schools and one doctor's surgery? You know, how are we going to deal with this increase in demand? And that's why you need to build more of those things as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's absolutely, I've said so many times that the housing crisis is absolutely at the core of so many of the issues in this country. And I think, you know, it is absolutely the case that the government need to do everything they can to just get building. One of the reasons why Rishi Sunak's government started to fail very, very quickly is because he couldn't get his party to vote for his national housing targets.
Yeah.
Because the Conservatives are full of NIMBYs who don't want more development in their area because they don't want the price of their own house to decrease. They don't want more, they don't want to struggle with access to their local services. You know, I understand that point, but that's why you have to keep building.
And so NIMBYs are not in my backyard. Yeah. And the idea is, generally, everybody agrees we need more housing. Mm. I think when you look at polling across the country, everybody agrees we need more housing. But then when it comes to where that is, everyone's like, okay, but not here, right? Somewhere else. I guess the question is, isn't this in some ways helpful to local councils? Because there'll be a lot of local councillors, council leaders, cabinet members who agree, but who have pressures internally in terms of locally within their communities. This is a good person to blame, right? They can say, look, it's out of my hands, it's central government.
Precisely. And I think, you know, the other thing is creating those 300 additional planning officers to speed up the planning process, because things would just get lost in we have a very archaic planning system and we have not nearly enough planning officers for the amount of planning applications. I was listening to the radio yesterday. Someone was saying, a developer rang up and said it had taken him 10 years to get a decision for new housing on a Brown Bear area, which absolutely needed new housing, you know, because the system is so bunged up. So being able to have more resource, but you're right, also having oversight at a top level where actually those councils can say, look, it's out of our hands, we have to build these new houses, they have to go somewhere and they're going here, I think is a good thing.
And what are the tangible sort of, what impacts would that have? So if we meet the 370,000 homes in individual councils, I imagine, or this is giving councils overall a 370,000 homes. Because often you get sort of people saying both things at the same time. So if you go into a local, I used to be a councillor in Heathrow Villages. Mm. You go into the Heathrow Villages and basically people say, don't build on any of these spaces, but also my kids can't get a home. It's too expensive. They can't get on the housing ladder. What do these extra homes mean? Mm. What material difference would it make on people's lives? Is it lower costs of housing? Would people get on the housing ladder? What sort of reality is that?
Yeah, so they want to do 1.5 million homes over 5 years. Mm. Obviously, these homes take a while to get built. But the idea is once you know, it's supply and demand, once you increase the supply, then the cost overall should decrease. Now, obviously, if you look at somewhere like London, where there's always going to be a real demand on housing, you're still going to have higher prices. And this is another point people make, that these homes have to be built in the right areas. There's no point building a load of homes for starter couples, families in a place with no jobs, for example. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that all needs to be taken into account. But that is exactly why Labour are being quite top down about this, because they want to be able to make sure that this is a whole joined up project, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, ultimately, if we build more houses, logic and economics suggest that the price of housing should come down, and therefore the price of renting should come down as well. But these things take time, and you know, we also have problems in this country about the quality of housing that is built, the affordability. So what you need is not just 4 and 5 bedroom homes being built, you need smaller flats being built, you know, you need appropriate starter homes so that young people can get on the housing ladder.
And are we talking about, I imagine it's a combination of sort of private building and council homes as well, because one of the key things is the lack of council housing that's available. I grew up in a council house, for example. So many of my friends grew up in a council house. That is really, really critical in terms of the housing crisis in the UK. Have the government spoken about at all about, are there like projected targets for council housing? I've not seen any.
No,
right? It's just about building.
Yes, they haven't put a figure on social housing, although they have pledged to increase that too. And that's quite an interesting one, because we know that there is, I think it's 1.6 million or something people on the social housing waiting list in this country. And, you know, I know they've done a pause on right to buy, I believe, which is a good thing. But obviously, yes, social housing, we massively need more social housing as well. And of course, the other thing is we need to massively upscale the quality of our existing homes. So there's lots of development that's happened over the past few years. years, which is insufficient. You know, there are homes of really poor quality being built, but also there's things like retrofitting. So if you live in a really old property, you know, it's actually up to scale and up to the standards necessary. So there's so much that needs to be done in this country in housing. It's not just building more housing. It's an issue of affordability and it's an issue of quality as well.
Yeah. But it's also, we've spoken about the housing issue a lot because it has such far-reaching impacts. Because, so for me, there's such huge opportunities in terms of the environmental cause and policy positions, right? Because we've had guests on the show who talk about the need to insulate Britain's homes. Well, this can be part of the program of building new homes, making sure that they're insulated, for example. They're the economic impacts. This government is obsessed with growth, economic growth. You know, having available, affordable homes is surely a part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It must be and it should be. I mean, the other thing I would say is that there is a real issue for Labour in just sort of like the political feasibility of this, because while they have 1.5 million, Keir Starmer kind of rode back on it a little bit the other day. He said it was I can't remember his exact wording, but he was basically saying that it is a sort of pie in the sky target, but it's good to have those targets because it really pushes you, which, you know, makes sense. But 1.5 million is a hell of a lot of homes when you have a lot of people who are opposed to more development in their area. The other thing is that there is a worry whether we have enough construction workers in this country to build that number of houses, especially since we left the EU and that our construction industry has taken a real hit. So this is another issue. And of course, one of the things that the anti-immigration lobby like to pick up on is the housing crisis. So they say if you bring over more immigrants to help us build homes, where are they going to live? So there's this kind of slightly cyclical element to all of this, which is
See the Angela Rayner interview on Sunday?
What happened?
A car crash. So she was asked on Sky News, I think it was Trevor Phillips, asked her around what you were saying now. So she kind of spoke about how little homes there are in Britain and how we need to build more, and then she was asked about the increase in immigration figures that came out and where are they going. And she said, well, there are plenty of homes that they're going into. And she was kind of caught up on how can you say at the same time that there are plenty of homes and not enough homes. And I think that plays into the fears that Labour have of the sort of growing of the far right and immigration. But that also goes to kind of one of the central problems our country has in its economy, in that even if we're being ambitious, and I'm going to ask you about the politics of it in a second, even if we're being ambitious to build 1.5 million homes, more healthcare, for example, that we'll need to facilitate those communities, more pharmacies, more schools, more teachers. There just isn't enough of that with our population now.
Yeah.
Immigration is huge to that, right? So if we look at the rise of America's economic growth in the 1950s, a large part of the migration was imported, the workforce was imported. So are Labour going to have to get over that?
Yeah.
So because if they want to build, like one of the key things you just mentioned that I hadn't even thought about until you just said it, was someone's going to need to build these houses. Yeah. If we don't have enough construction workers, are they just going to have to get over their fear of Farage and import it in?
It's this, I mean, there's a real argument to be made that the Conservatives, having kind of presided over, you know, Keir Starmer called it an open borders policy. I don't know if I'd quite call it that, but definitely a period of kind of historically high immigration because our economy needed it. At the same time, they were besotted by a bunch of NIMBYs who didn't want them to build enough. So yes, now we do have a housing shortage, and yes, the fact that we have quite a lot of immigration in this country, obviously there is a conflict there, but as you say, you need those immigrants to build those houses and work in the health service and all these other things,
or it would take us 35 years
exactly. So yes, this again seems to me to be another example of how badly damaged the country is from conservative political short-sightedness.
Can I ask you about the politics of all this? Starmer has a little bit of a history of U-turns. He's going to get a lot of flack for this and a lot of pushback on it specifically. He already is, to be honest. But he seems to be powering through, even though he's kind of rolled back on the numbers, like you said. He seems to be powering through. What's the political context in terms of what he has to look forward to, both internally from the party and the position the Conservatives might take? And do you think he's right and should just power through?
I think he's right and should just power through. You know, I understand Keir Starmer gets a lot of I'm not going to massively defend Keir Starmer for going back on his promises and being uninspiring and Labour having what to me is pretty terrible messaging at the minute. But I think there is something important that he's doing, which is some grown-up politics, which is the Conservatives just basically did whatever they wanted for 14 years with no strategic oversight of what was going to happen to the country in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. They didn't care. You know, everything they did was politically advantageous to them at that
time. In the short term as well.
Yes. Yeah. Keir Starmer is looking more long term. Is he going to see the benefit in 5 years of promising to build loads of houses and cutting your nan's winter fuel allowance? Probably not. It's going to make him more unpopular. But his, what he's trying to do is rebalance things and look at long-term projects. And, you know, this someone had to build these houses and someone had to stand up to the NIMBYs. Otherwise, they'd never get done.
Exactly. And this is where he has said the sort of doing the painful things and the right things first so we can move on. He can actually enjoy some political benefit of it. It's funny. I was on Question Time in 2019 and I was attacking the Tories for the number of houses they built. If Starmer imagines himself 5 years from now in a general election campaign saying we were able to build 200,000 homes across Britain, that's hugely politically advantageous, even if it's painful now.
And I think the public now understand that that is something that needs to be done. So I do think he has the public on side with him with this. Okay, coming up, should other political parties be worried about Reform UK after the party led by Nigel Farage continue to go from strength to strength? We'll discuss all that and more next.
Fubar Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
cray,
truth.
Cray.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, Reform UK have had quite a successful year, winning 5 seats at the general election and taking millions of votes from the Tories, finally achieving their leader, Nigel Farage, his dream of a seat in the House of Commons. They've successfully converted Tory donors to their cause. I don't know who Tony is. And even the husband of former Tory Home Secretary Suella Braverman is rumoured to have defected, sparking discussions that she might well follow suit. But should any of this be a worry for the major political parties? Should the Tories or Labour be concerned about Reform becoming a serious force within UK politics? Or is this as good as it gets for the upstart right-wing party? Well, joining us to discuss Reform's successful year is Lord Hayward, Robert Hayward, a Conservative peer and polling expert. Thank you for joining us, Robert. Tell me, do you think Nigel Farage can be Prime Minister at the next general election?
No, but he can be a real threat to both political parties. As you said, at the last election, he took a lot of votes off the Conservatives. He also took a lot of votes off the other parties as well, but there's no question that he has taken more off the Conservatives, in part because the last election in the UK was about getting rid of the Conservatives. So therefore, former Conservatives were clearly going in every single direction. But if you look at the polling in terms of the rating of Nigel Farage and Reform, there is a very strong body of people who view him very positively, but he also has incredibly negative ratings amongst a very large number of people as well. And that will stop him becoming Prime Minister as such.
Lord Hayward, thank you so much for joining us. I just want to ask you, I have always understood British politics almost through the lens of the two big parties, Conservatives and Labour, and everyone outside of that kind of bit part players. Is that about to end with Reform? Are they overperforming your expectations?
I think we go through a cycle. We've actually had the Liberal Democrats at one point or another. We had UKIP for a very brief period. There's no question that Reform have outperformed, in part for the reason I just identified, i.e. that there was such a level of disaffection with the Conservative government after 14 years of administration. And people felt they weren't warm towards the Labour Party. What is striking is how incredibly small the vote share that the Labour Party got at the last election was. And that's just of those who voted. There was also a huge decline in the number of people who voted at all. So hit the Tories, didn't go to Labour, was looking for somewhere else to go, and Reform was quite definitely the prime option in numbers of votes. But although Reform got 5 seats, you have to remember that one of the other really big gainers in terms of quantities of seats was the Liberal Democrats, who gained huge numbers of seats, particularly in the home counties in England. Mm.
Robert, before you suggested that while Nigel Farage might be quite a big draw to some voters, he also might be very off-putting to other voters. Is there anything he can do to become more likeable or appealing to those voters who dislike him?
I think that's a challenge, and you'd probably be asking him to change his personality, and which he's not going to do. Mm. And of course, it's his very personality which many of the voters find attractive. Mm. So if he started changing what he is, he might be attractive to another group of voters, but he risks losing part of the group that is voting for him at the moment or attracted towards him and might be at the local elections next May here or alternatively at the next general election. Mm.
One of the things I'm curious about is we've had flashes in the pan before. We had it with UKIP, for example, like you've said. I'm trying to get a sense of, are they a flash in the pan? Are they just enjoying their moment? Or is this a significant shift in British politics? Because there are also rumours of Jeremy Corbyn starting a left-wing party in January with his other independents. Are we seeing a potential more multipolar, where we've got multiple parties vying for power, kind of like we see in some European countries? Or are these all flashes in the pan and we're going to retreat back to our two-party system, basically?
I don't think it's quite the same flash in the pan that we've had previously. You're right that UKIP rose and disappeared very rapidly. the problem for people who, and many of the people who were in UKIP previously are now in the Reform Party, they managed to row amongst themselves, which caused a lot of problems for the party. But we are in this country moving into a position where people are willing to move away from the traditional two-party system with possibly the Liberals as a third party or two-and-a-half party sort of thing. And people are looking in all sorts of different directions. Having said that, our voting system, first past the post, is distinctly disadvantageous to smaller new parties. And this is what Reform found. That they actually got a very large number of votes, but they didn't get anywhere near the number of seats that the Liberal Democrats do. You need to concentrate your support in specific constituencies because we have a first past the post system.
At present, Reform's major policy, I think it's fair to say, is on immigration. When you consider their other policies, do you think those would be hits with the British public? I mean, they're quite they've talked about sort of taking a French system of healthcare. They're quite low tax. They're quite anti-regulation for businesses. Are these things that might appeal to UK voters?
Each one of those potentially can appeal to a group in one direction or another. As a suite of policies, I'm not convinced that they will have a real appeal. We have the approach to the NHS, which is almost deification, and therefore suggesting that one goes to a French policy or whatever is really a view expressed by the rich community, the upper middle class community, in a way that would turn off many of the potential Reform voters in the Midlands and in the north of England, who feel that the suggestion that you would have to go through the routes of insurance policies and paying for seeing a GP would really irritate that group of voters. So there is this one key issue, immigration, that is attractive. Reform on other things has a broadly populist approach, but as long as immigration is a key issue and the Conservatives haven't got back to being perceived as competent by the population at large, and Labour haven't convinced the population that they're competent, Reform is an attractive party. But the what I describe as the subsidiary issues are not going to swing lots of people, and they might risk alienating some groups.
Can I ask from Labour's perspective? So I know for a fact that there are senior Labour Party decision makers who are petrified of Reform right now and are therefore changing their political strategy as a result. At the last general election, Reform mainly damaged mostly the Conservative Party. Should Labour be concerned and fearful of Reform?
Oh, there's no question they should be. And I think they are, as you say. Privately, they are very concerned. We have council by-elections every single week. And if you look at the council by-elections, some of the places, and Reform have actually not won many council by-elections, but they've won a seat in Wolverhampton. They came within single-figure votes of gaining a council seat on Sheffield the other day. So these are distinctly Labour. This is distinctly Labour territory. Mm-hmm. There's no question that in places like Nottinghamshire, Derbyshire, the metropolitan areas of the north, Reform are potentially very strong. And the thing that Nigel Farage will be praying for example, is a by-election in Runcorn up in Cheshire on the Cheshire-Lancashire border, because Reform came second, a long way behind Labour, but they came second there. And they would like the voting where the media is paying attention to be in Labour areas, because there's a very, very strong potential in those sorts of territories.
Can I just ask a follow-up about that? People like myself in the Labour Party are a little bit worried that Labour is feeding into Reform strategy. We saw Sir Keir Starmer do a big speech about immigration and use the term sort of open immigration, which wouldn't have been seen traditionally from a Labour leader. And the worries people like myself have is if we allow the terrain, the fight to be on immigration, on issues that Reform are strong in, we're always going to lose. Am I right in that, or can Labour regain that sort of message? In that space,
You're definitely right in that. But the advantage that Labour has is that as the government, it should be able to direct the agenda onto other issues, whether that's planning and housing or the health service or schools or environment. The Labour government should have that as its beneficial card, its positive card. So you take the argument away from immigration for much of the time. But there's no question that Labour is very worried and has to find a way. It has to tackle immigration. And it's got to convince the electorate that it is doing so. But it can also find ways of changing the agenda onto other subjects.
Fascinating stuff. Lord Hayward, thank you so much for joining us. That was Lord Hayward, Robert Hayward, a Conservative peer and polling expert.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Ali, what did you make of Lord Hayward there? What stood out to you? I think he said some very interesting things, made me feel slightly less concerned.
Yeah, fascinating. First of all, I'm happy he said my sort of worries aren't crazy. I actually think we're making a serious mistake. I think we're making the same mistake Labour made in 2008. Mm. In 2008, Labour, and I know it's early, I know we're like 6 months into a Labour government, but in the early days of the 2008 crash, Labour allowed the sort of status quo to become Labour overspent, and Labour pushed us into a crash into our economy, basically. And it was as a result of overspending that the economy crashed in 2008, which is factually incorrect. And that's dominated the space and the status quo for so long that when Ed Miliband, years later, I think 7 years later, stood up on the Question Time stage during a general election and he was asked, did Labour overspend? And he said no. The audience audibly gasped that he would have the audacity to say no, because that had become the status quo. If we allow at this early stage the terrain to become there's too much immigration, open immigration, all that kind of stuff, that provides the space for Nigel Farage to feel extremely comfortable in. That's my worry.
Yeah.
Although also at this stage, I actually think that Nigel Farage might become the Prime Minister. So I was really interested to hear that. I mean, he will know better than me the numbers, that that's probably very unlikely.
I don't think Nigel Farage is going to be Prime Minister.
And could are different things. Yeah, I think he could.
I don't think he could. And I think it's for the reasons that Lord Hayward said, which is that when you drill down into reforms policies...
Beyond immigration,
yeah, they're incongruous. They don't appeal to one... They don't appeal to the majority British voter. So while if you look at similar parties across Europe to Nigel Farage, some might call them far right, they tend to be a little bit more kind of status. So there's like welfare chauvinism. They're bigger on the role of the state, protecting certain services. Nigel Farage is actually, you know, he's talked about wanting to privatise healthcare. He's talked about wanting to move to a French health insurance system. He's talked about lower taxes. He's talked about cutting red tape for businesses. Actually, that doesn't perform well, as Lord Hayward was saying, with the ex-Labour voter in the Red Wall, who actually cares a lot about the NHS, who actually, one of the reasons they're worried about immigration is because of things like that.
But that's the space I think we have to fight him. I think you're right. I think once you get rid of immigration, he's not got much else to say that's popular. And Lord Hayward said we deify the NHS, and he's right. I actually think that's a good thing, because if you look at all the other systems, keeping it at the top of the agenda is really critical. But I think 84% of the British public are in support of the NHS. In every single election and every single poll in that election, the NHS has been a top three issue, usually two or one, in terms of what people think. And so the Reform Party having such an unpopular position on such an issue that Lord Hayward referred to as us deifying could be a silver bullet to put them down. But the problem is, to put them down, the other parties have to do that. They have to have that fight.
So this is the problem, you know, and I think, I wonder if now what Labour needs to do, you know, is really think about their view on spending and their view on public services. And one of the things that the right across Europe are doing quite successfully is they are handing things to young people who are struggling with the housing market, who are struggling with unemployment. You know, they are giving them tax breaks, handouts, pots of money, you know. And I wonder if Labour should be looking a bit more seriously it's a Labour government. People expected to spend. Maybe it should be doing some spending.
Yeah, and that's, again, Lord Hayward made reference to that. The benefit of being in government, the benefit of incumbency is you can do things the other parties can't. Yeah. You can set the agenda based on what you're actually doing and how you're actually spending. Again, the worry is Keir Starmer's done this big speech about open immigration and how we'll deport more than you will. People just don't buy that, to be honest. You can't have that fight with Nigel Farage the same way you couldn't have that fight with Donald Trump. So I think you're right. I think ultimately, even if the major parties don't have that fight, eventually there's going to be more than immigration that reform is going to have to talk about. And they're either going to have to change their policy or it's going to be desperately unpopular.
And you know why I don't think they'll change their policy? Because they are a party that is bankrolled by billionaires and now tech bros.
Nick Candy, right. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Really interesting discussions, and thank you to Lord Hayward for joining us. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can also find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FubarRadio.com or on the Fubar Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored. Slums.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.